It's a very important topic this evening. It's something that we all think about and worry about. Anyone who's read Neil Ferguson's latest book, Civilization, The West and the Rest, will see that he concludes by saying that when civilizations collapse or start falling apart, they tend to do so rapidly. And if you look back in history, in very recent history, you can see what happened to the so-called Soviet civilization, a contradiction in terms perhaps. You can see what's happening with the what you could loosely define as the Arab civilization right now. You can certainly look at the British Empire and how rapidly that fell apart after World War II. You could go back to the Roman Empire. So the big question we face today, and which is going to be the topic of this evening's event, is can the US, I guess, keep it all together in the 21st century? We all have a stake in the answer to that question. It's one that, of course, is uncertain. The outcome is very much uncertain. When we began this century, the US was the dominant superpower. Whether it will end this century as the dominant superpower is another question. Obviously, we have rising powers coming up, China and India and so on. The US certainly is in relative decline against these other powers, which makes for a very interesting history in the next few years. The US today we see is in a frightful mess financially and economically. It's very worrying for everyone. Just look at our exchange rate at the moment. Just look at the US unemployment rate, the number of mortgage defaults. It goes on and on. The US traditionally has been able to pull itself out of these crises through its wonderful capacity to regenerate, to revive, to reinvent itself. No doubt, while I believe it will do so again, but it might take some time. So we're going to be in for some tricky times coming up, and it's very useful at times like this to have a kind of philosophical look at the problems facing an increasingly polarized political setup in the US, its financial and economic problems, and where this may all lead. And no one is better equipped to guide us through this whole philosophical debate than Paul Monk, who I would regard as a living intellectual treasure in Melbourne, who has spoken here on several previous occasions, who is the author of a number of wonderful books, a great thinker around town, a polymath, and we're very pleased to welcome him back this evening. Paul?
Good evening. I'm not sure about the polymath. It's a very flattering description, but I can say I'm a Collingwood supporter, and so I love playing to a big crowd. And thank you for all coming out tonight. Pardon me. My understanding of what such an evening calls for is not an overly rich, data-driven lecture, but a thought-provoking talk. And what I really look forward to is the discussion with you afterwards. So my talk should take about 25 minutes, and given that we're due to finish at 7, that should leave us quite a bit of time for questions and answers, and I hope that'll be a lot of fun. So I hope you'll find my remarks provocative. They certainly won't be exhaustive, but they were initially prompted by the killing of Osama bin Laden and the desire to try and put that in the perspective of the larger challenges facing the United States. So I've actually called the talk Keeping the Insulation from Coming Undone, which is a phrase that is derived from Leon Wieseltier's comments about the death of Osama bin Laden and its significance. Just over a month ago, American Special Forces entered Pakistani territory in secret, then entered a secure compound long inhabited by Osama bin Laden, his family, and a few close aides, and killed the famous leader of Al-Qaeda. Almost incredibly, the whole thing was watched live on video cam from the White House. This was itself a remarkable achievement, in its own grim way, a kind of signature effect in our time. The enemy was not just tracked down on the other side of the world at the behest of the President of the United States. The actual ambush and killing of the archenemy was watched live by the President of the United States and his closest aides. It was a dramatic moment, and by any measure, a striking denouement to the assault on the United States in 2001 and the boast of Osama bin Laden that he would bring the United States to its knees. This evening, however, what I want to discuss with you are the ways in which the United States has almost been brought to its knees by its own follies, even as it fended off the Islamist assault and finally destroyed the Muslim fanatic who had boasted that he would inflict lethal blows on the great Satan from his hideout on the far side of the world. I shall argue that the most damaging blows to the prestige, wealth, and geopolitical supremacy of the United States over the past 20 years have not come from external enemies, but from its own errors and extravagances, both in domestic and in foreign policy. I shall argue that this should concern all of us, since the preeminence of the United States over the past 70 years, and it is still not quite 70 years since the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, has all things considered, been a boon to the world. Should the Great Republic go into sharp and even irreversible decline, the consequences for all of us could be far more serious than a great many people appreciate. Let me begin by briefly recapping on the significance of Osama bin Laden and his fate. The assault on America on 11 September 2001 came proverbially out of a blue sky, both literally and metaphorically. As the noted Jewish-American commentator Leon Wieseltier expressed it, the American insulation had come undone. It was one of those moments, our strong and lucky history has spared us many such grim epiphanies, when you recognise again how much your country, how much this country matters. The American insulation had come undone. Remember that phrase. I'll come back to it. The celebrations that immediately followed bin Laden's demise should be seen in this light. As Wieseltier pointed out in the pages of the New Republic, a certain wittiness at the time showed the spirit of the Republic. Osama bin Gotten, and Donald Trump wants to see Osama bin Laden's death certificate, are two of the more notable quips. These celebrations are surely understandable. Those who unctuously intone that the taking of any human life is always to be regretted and that Osama bin Laden should have been arrested and put on trial were, I suggest, forgetting themselves. I'm reminded of the exchange between Viktor Komarovsky and Yuri Zhivago concerning the suicide of Pasha Antipov, Strelnikov, in David Lean's famous film of Dr. Zhivago, where Komarovsky declares harshly to the shocked Zhivago, "Spare me your expressions of regret. He was a murderous neurotic and of no loss to anyone." Osama bin Laden was every bit as murderous as Strelnikov, and he did not commit suicide like Strelnikov in remorse for having sacrificed love for the empty cause of violent revolution. Osama demonstrably died planning multiple further atrocities. He was killed on the field of battle, and we should not mourn his passing. Michael Scheuer's study of Osama bin Laden, released just before the master terrorist was cornered and killed, showed him great respect as an enemy who understood America better than the masters of war in the United States understood him. So might a Roman analyst have written of Hannibal's relentless campaign against the Roman Republic. Those of you who know your ancient history will recall that Hannibal also was defeated and pursued to the east, to the very courts of Mithridates of Pontus, where he was continuing to plot assaults on Rome. Rather than submit to capture or betrayal, Hannibal took poison and died, while Osama bin Laden reached for a gun, it seems, and was shot. In both cases, a mortal enemy was brought to heel, and the celebration as well as relief in the Republic was palpable. The Roman antecedent suggests, however, that our attention should be focused less on the death of an enemy long beaten back and at bay than on the condition of the Republic itself. After the defeat of Hannibal, Rome apparently went from strength to strength as it conquered the entire Mediterranean basin. The Republic, however, suffered from ever more acute internal corruption, constitutional crisis, and social disorder, which culminated, after a series of civil wars, in its downfall and the rise of the empire. Right now, in the wake of the killing of Osama bin Laden, who never did achieve the status of a Hannibal for all his dark ambitions, the internal condition and global standing of the United States cry out for careful examination and serious reform. For economically, socially, morally, politically, and geopolitically, the United States is far from being in mint condition, and I use that expression quite deliberately, in all the circumstances. So much is this so that were I a lecturer in ancient history at a good university or a liberal arts college of the kind this country conspicuously lacks, I would be guiding my students this year through a close reading of Livy's Rome in the Mediterranean and Ronald Syme's The Roman Revolution. The Great Republic has been gravely weakened over the past decade, not by terrorism, but by debacles almost wholly of its own making. and the disgraceful debacle of 2008, the effects of which are still being felt, came perilously close to bringing its insulation undone in a way Osama bin Laden had never been able to do. The US operation to kill bin Laden was codenamed Operation Geronimo, which shows how much confusion there is concerning the kind of danger he posed. This designation was vehemently protested by the Apache leader's great-grandson, Harlan Geronimo, on the 5th of May this year, as a grave insult to Geronimo. Perhaps, however, the analogy is of some use, in that Geronimo had long since been on the run when finally cornered and captured by the US cavalry, and had never posed an existential threat to the United States. Over several decades, he had killed hundreds of Mexicans, whom he despised, but relatively few citizens of the United States, though his raids spanned New Mexico, Arizona, and western Texas. Osama had certainly done more direct harm and aspired to do far more, but so long as the United States had its house in order, there was simply no way he could have dealt it an existential blow. We need to be clear about this. A United States in sound economic order and sound political order would always have been able to absorb any conceivable blow that al-Qaeda could have dealt it. The United States, however, is not in sound economic or political order. It has delivered a series of mighty blows to itself, all on its own, and they are far from having been fully absorbed as we gather here this evening. The image of the World Trade Center Twin Towers crumbling as the sun shone over New York was unforgettably dramatic. But the realities of the US economy being shaken to its very foundations by fiscal mismanagement, corporate corruption, and the sheer stupidity of Wall Street bond traders over the past decade should actually disturb us a great deal more. The increasingly polarized and demagogical character of politics in the United States, the dominance of bully pulpit propaganda and irresponsible rhetoric over serious and principled debate are profoundly troubling. This is all the more so because of the similar malaise in both the European Union and Japan. It is less than a decade since the publication in New York of Michael Mandelbaum's book, The Ideas That Conquered the World, Peace, Democracy, and Free Markets in the 21st Century. Yet we have seen in the past few years that all three could yet suffer grave setbacks unless the underlying vitality of the liberal democracies and above all of the United States can be restored. Much of the blame for this tends, understandably, to get laid at the door of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. They get pilloried for cutting taxes while launching two expensive foreign wars, for politicizing and bungling intelligence assessments with regard to Iraq, for being somehow complicit in the Enron scandal and the moral taint it spread over the supposedly booming economy of the United States, for abrasive American unilateralism, and for failing to head off the economic debacle we all know as the GFC. They deserve much of this criticism. But the problems run deeper and go back further than the Bush administration. The relentless decline in financial prudence on Wall Street also goes back many years before Bush and cannot be laid at the door of the Republican Party alone. The long reign of Alan Greenspan at the Federal Reserve did America harm, and neither Greenspan nor any of his circle has been adequately held to account. Indeed, one of the notable features of the economic debate since 2008 has been the tendency of too many Republicans and Libertarians to deny that corporate corruption, recklessness, and inadequate regulatory oversight contributed anything to the catastrophic debacle of 2008. There has been something of an avalanche of books about the global financial crisis and the corruption and near self-destruction of Wall Street, but none, I think, more readable, more illuminating, or more devastating than Michael Lewis's The Big Short. Some of you will be acquainted with the little book that made Lewis his name in 1989, Liar's Poker, about his strange experience working at Salomon Brothers in the mid-1980s. As a young man not yet 30 years old, Lewis wrote in 1989, "I set out to write this book only because I thought it would be better to tell the story than to go on living the story." 20 years later, incredulous at what had occurred in the intervening years, in which he had become a writer celebrated for his intelligence, dry wit, and unpretentious style, he wrote about what he called the doomsday machine that had taken the American economy and democratic governance to the verge of breakdown. I want to share a little of this with you, because as much as any more detailed analysis, for which, in any case, I do not have the time or space this evening, the story that he tells takes us to the heart of what I believe should most concern us, far more than the life or death of one Arabian brigand and jihadist. Lewis titled the prologue to his 2010 book, The Big Short, Poltergeist. These were his opening remarks. The willingness of a Wall Street investment bank to pay me hundreds of thousands of dollars to dispense investment advice to grown-ups remains a mystery to me to this day. I was 24 years old, with no experience of or particular interest in guessing which stocks and bonds would rise and which would fall. Wall Street's essential function was to allocate capital, to decide who should get it and who should not. Believe me when I tell you that I hadn't the first clue. He wrote Liar's Poker, he went on to say, because he thought that unless some insider got all of this down on paper, no future human would believe that it had happened. He added, what I never imagined is that a future reader might look back on any of this or on my own peculiar experience and say, how quaint, how innocent. And when you read his or any one of a number of the recent books on the debauching and near bankrupting of America, you understand without any difficulty just why he wrote that. Among the very many details on which it is important to reflect from this whole wretched and morally disgraceful episode, let me single out just one anecdote related by Lewis, which I think is emblematic of the pervasive problem facing the Western democracies, and not just the United States, in our time. It concerns a huge gathering of bond traders and their hangers-on in Las Vegas in January 2007, which was also attended by a small number of skeptics and mavericks seeking to calibrate their independent judgments that the mortgage and bond markets were locked in a death spiral that could bring the American insulation undone in a spectacular way. Lewis relates that on the first morning of the conference, a crowd of thousands flowed out of the casino into the vast main ballroom to attend the opening ceremony. The moderator of this opening ceremony, Lewis was informed, appeared to be drunk, or at least unhinged. His name was John Devaney, and he ran a hedge fund that invested in subprime mortgage bonds, United Capital Markets. For a decade now, Devaney had sponsored this conference, called ASF, or the American Securitization Forum, in part because it sounded more dignified than the Association for Subprime Lending. To the extent that the market for subprime mortgage bonds had moral leaders, John Devaney was one. He was also an enthusiastic displayer of his own wealth. He owned a Renoir, a Gulfstream, a helicopter, plus, of course, a yacht. This year, he'd paid some huge sum to fly in Jay Leno to serve as entertainment. Now, looking as though he had just strolled in from a night on the town without pausing to take a nap, John Devaney delivered what was clearly an extemporaneous rant about the state of the subprime market. It was incredible, said Charlie Ledley, Lewis's informant. Stream of consciousness. He went on about how the ratings agencies were whores, how the securities were worthless, how they all knew it. He gave words to stuff we were just suspecting. It was like he was talking out of school. When he was finished, there was complete silence. No one specifically attempted a defence. They just talked around him. It was like everyone pretended he hadn't said it. Ponder that scene. And that coda to it. That is the world we all live in, not merely with regard to the specific financial crisis in the American housing and bond market, but more generally with regard to the challenges we face as a species. But it is stunning, even if we confine our reflections to its implications for the American economy. The overwhelming impression one gets from the accounts of the financial crisis provided by Lewis and others, such as Roger Lowenstein or William Cohen, is that the mortgage industry, the bond trading houses and the investment banks, the US Federal Reserve, the ratings agencies, the US Treasury, and virtually every other theoretically accountable body in the Great Republic was either unwilling or unable to see the crisis coming or do anything to avert it. Nor were any of them very willing in its wake to accept responsibility for it. The collapse in 1998 of long-term capital management, headed by the former head of Salomon Brothers Bond Trading, John Merriweather, should have prompted much closer regulatory oversight of financial markets. It didn't. In fact, over the following 12 months, Alan Greenspan, Larry Summers, Robert Rubin, and other leading figures in US financial regulation aggressively deflected the attempts by Brooksley Bourne, chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, to generate a debate about whether derivative instruments should be allowed to function in a regulatory vacuum. The dot-com bubble burst a year or so later, demonstrating definitively that Greenspan and Bernanke and others had been fundamentally in error in dismissing both the desirability of deflating bubbles and even the reality of bubbles as such. The Enron scandal demonstrated that financial corruption, fundamental corruption of fiduciary and prudential oversight had occurred in the American corporate world. Yet nothing was done which might have prevented that corruption from totally compromising the three premier ratings agencies in the ensuing few years in their dealings with the bond traders and investment banks. At the same time, the Bush administration was rapidly turning the surpluses and apparent promise of the Clinton years into yawning deficits on the grounds that, in Dick Cheney's notorious words, Reagan showed that debt doesn't matter. This fiscally reckless attitude prompted the resignation of Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill after the first 2 years of the younger Bush's first presidency. O'Neill resigned because he believed that the Bush-Cheney White House was being fundamentally and incorrigibly irresponsible in its macroeconomic policy. It had undertaken sweeping tax cuts while launching two expensive wars and was secretive about its operations to an extent that O'Neill believed was wholly counterproductive. And even as the Bush administration cut taxes, launched wars, and neglected the basic regulatory institutions of the Great Republic, the mortgage market was spiralling out of control and the Wall Street bond traders were making a killing by ever more cynical, fraudulent, deluded, and unsustainable means. The single most disturbing feature of all this, arguably, was that the top-tier managers of the biggest risk and capital management institutions in the most sophisticated capitalist country in history failed to understand where all this was heading until it was too late, and then ran to the federal government looking for public bailouts when, morally speaking, they should have been hung out to swing in the wind. As Lewis Mordantly observed, it was the call by Meredith Whitney, an analyst at the small and independent firm of Oppenheimer & Company, in October 2007, that Citigroup's management was not so much corrupt as stupid that opened up the can of worms. They didn't know how to manage their own capital, to say nothing of the nation's or the world's. And they were far from being alone, as it turned out, whether in America or in Europe. Not for the first time, but surely in a more than ever infuriating way, the world of democratic capitalism had been very badly served by its supposedly leading lights. But it is just as important to emphasise that the public debt piled up in the name of Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid in the United States, and the literally insane leveraging indulged in by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the years leading up to the 2008 crisis, have also been and remain very important maladies in the American economy. It would be well to remember that the Roman Republic was torn apart not by war between corrupt plutocrats and virtuous Republican plebeians, but in a series of civil wars between those who clung to the old order in the hope that it could somehow be salvaged and those who sought to replace it with a form of monarchy because they had lost belief in the old Republican institutions. There was at least as many demagogues on the revolutionary side as on the patrician side, and the outcome was a tyranny, even if it was also a more stable imperial government. The Republican Party right now often looks cranky and irrational, but the Democratic Party at times looks ideologically self-indulgent and delusional. And none of this is good news for those of us who have long regarded the American Republic, with all its flaws, as the chief guarantor of global security and prosperity. The alarming decline in the quality of American public education for decades now is another sign of decay. And contrary to the ideological rallying cries of Democrats or their socialist partisans elsewhere, these problems have not, let me repeat, not been caused by lack of government spending. Spending on education, as on healthcare in the United States, has been trending relentlessly up since the Great Society legislation passed by Lyndon Johnson in 1965, and now totals about 7% of GDP in each case, substantially more than is spent on defence. As Christopher Chantrill put it in an analysis of US government spending in the 20th century, nobody in 1900, speculating on the future of government, could have imagined the astonishing growth and scope of government in the 20th century. Nor would they have imagined that for many people, this gigantic government would seem the very essence of efficiency, compassion, and modernity. But the reason that government has got so big is not, as many claim, the weight of armaments and wars. Instead, the money goes for healthcare, education, pensions, and welfare programs. The grim truth confronting the Keynesians and socialists right now, in both the United States and the EU, is that their economic model is unsustainable as things stand. Yet the very democratic politics on which we all pride ourselves make it exceptionally difficult to rationalise the welfare entitlements put in place in decades past and long since seen as the birthright of citizens of these societies. The core problem has been the piling up of entitlements based on pork barrelling, budgetary irresponsibility, complacency, and the relentless, self-interested lobbying of often unionised interest groups. The problems absolutely will not be solved merely by pouring more tax dollars into them. And in any case, there simply are no more tax dollars to be poured. The Western welfare state, built on a Keynesian foundation, is everywhere insolvent and needs to be fundamentally rethought and remodeled. Seen in this context, the killing of Osama bin Laden is a sideshow. While no doubt a little more significant than the killing of Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker in May 1934, in the midst of the Great Depression and the international rise of fascism, it should be seen as that kind of event at the end of the day. What is far more important than celebrating the demise of one more murderous thug is seeing America's fiscal and political house put in order, intelligently and democratically, and we are a long way from seeing that done right now. In fact, one has the impression that between them, Wall Street, the US Congress, the sprawling Washington bureaucracy, and the even more sprawling polyglot American public are entirely unable to agree on how to put things in good order and condition. In the circumstances, more than passing jubilation at the event in Abbottabad is an unwarranted distraction. What would be more salutary is dispassionate reflection on the seriousness of the challenges confronting democratic capitalism and the apparently intractable difficulties our institutions face in confronting them. Note that, to this point, I have said nothing about international trade regimes, environmental challenges, weapons of mass destruction, the rise of China and its uncertain ambitions, or the looming problems of energy supply and resource security in a world striving relentlessly to emulate more than to transcend the American and European standard of living. These are all challenges that face the United States as much as anyone else, and although Barack Obama has an unusual capacity to make a speech, there are few signs that he is proving able to get on top even of the fiscal challenges that confront his country, to say nothing of these other formidable challenges. Since I have several times invoked the Roman Republic in these remarks this evening, let me echo a very famous Roman Republican statesman, Marcus Porcius Cato the Elder, 234-149 BC, who, after a visit to North Africa in 153 BCE, took to ending every speech he gave to the Roman Senate with the resounding refrain, Carthago delendar est, Carthage must be destroyed. Our equivalent refrain should be much less simple and much less martial. It might take the form, sustainability must be assured. And whereas Cato the Elder was renowned for his opposition to new ideas in Roman morals and society, we are in urgent need of new ideas and social innovation in the 21st century, if the 21st century is to become one of human promise rather than of Western civilization and global order stumbling into disarray and even disaster. About 5 years before the financial crisis broke upon the world, James McDonald, a British investment banker of many years' experience, took time out to write a very thoughtful book about public credit and democratic governance. It was called A Free Nation Deep in Debt, The Financial Roots of Democracy. In it, he argued that what we might call democratic government, that is, government in which the citizens, even if a gender, property, and race-restricted minority of them, vote on public policy, instead of an autocrat or oligarchy monopolising this prerogative. This, he said, facilitated the rise of public credit, first in the classical Greek and Hellenistic world, and then again in the Italian cities of the Renaissance. This made possible the dynamic economies of the modern era. But the virtuous relationship between democratic government and public credit, he argued, has broken down due to the extravagant use of borrowing by democratic government to fund unsustainable welfare entitlements since the Great Depression and especially since the 1960s. The tax rate in the United States rose, he pointed out, from around 4% of GDP in the 1930s to almost 20% in the 1980s. And the continuing ballooning in public expenditure since then has been funded by debt. In reflecting on this state of affairs, 5 years before the global financial crisis, McDonald expressed the sense that something had to give in the Western democracies because they had long since lost any disciplined sense of what was sustainable in fiscal policy. He quotes an 18th century political theorist, Alexander Teitler, as having written, "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury. From that point on, the majority always votes for the candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, always followed by a dictatorship." While there does not seem to be an immediate prospect of the collapse of democratic government in the West in the wake of the 2008 crisis, it is salutary to think in these terms, because the problem did not start in the 2000s, it has not been remotely resolved as of 2011, and there are a disturbing number of signs that cognitively and fiscally we are all rather like those thousands at Las Vegas in January 2007, having moved from the casino to the ballroom and hearing a kind of rant from the podium, but responding as if we are not actually hearing or heeding the words spoken, the warnings being given, the growing evidence that things are quite seriously and profoundly awry. We, of course, are not in Rome, but in the equivalent of Rhodes or Kos, island democracies on the fringes of the Greco-Roman world. Let no one think, however, that Rome's problems are not ours. We are deeply implicated, and the problems are serious. The killing of Osama bin Laden has no significant bearing on them, and they will not be resolved without quite fundamental rethinking of long-standing assumptions about the roots and management of our well-being. Let me end my rant from the podium at this point and invite you to respond not by talking around what I've said, not by silence, but with questions of all kinds, which I shall attempt to address to the best of my ability. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Many thought-provoking statements there. Let's open up the floor for comments and questions. Keep your comments and questions short, please, and please identify yourselves just before you ask your question or give your comment. Robin.
Hi, I'm Robin from the Institute. I always remember George Bush listening to a woman about how she had to work three jobs and how his response was, "Isn't this America wonderful?" And I actually don't think a person who has to work three jobs is a good outcome. Would you care to comment on, say, jobs, how under the level of job payment, how much is that a part of the economy that people seem to get paid very little? And it contributes to issues of inequality in the economy, and it contributes to issues of a need for the government to provide that sort of support.
That's of course a very large question. There are a couple of possible approaches to it. I can't recall the precise incident, but I was often worried when George Bush commented on any number of things, because you could never be sure where he was going to come from. And one of my favourite Bushes is when he was talking about the apparent sclerosis in the French economy. And he said, "You know, the French have no word for entrepreneur." It's very sweet, really, isn't it? A man grew up in Texas. I think that you can approach this question of wage levels from two different directions. One is to point to what clearly has been a widening gap in wages and salaries, or bonuses going to ordinary people, not least in the United States, compared with those being harvested by CEOs, and particularly in the last decade or two by people in the finance industry. As Lewis himself says, he was really rather shocked that somebody like John Gottfried, for whom he worked in the 1980s, could be paid $3.1 million for the work he did, when he, as Lewis says, wasn't doing anything of any obvious social utility. When Richard Fuld, who took Lehman Brothers over the edge, went before a Senate committee in the wake of the global financial crisis, Senator Dodd, as I recall, said to him, "I don't understand, Mr. Fuld, that over the last 5 years, while you took this 158-year-old institution to and then over the edge, you were paid $480 million in salary and bonuses." And Fuld looked rather taken aback to be even asked the question, and he said, "Senator, that's not true. No, I was paid $380 million." this is a sort of unreality, And if you contrast this, plenty many people have been doing, you contrast that kind of unreality with the rather grim reality that many ordinary people face, then it's quite understandable that you're getting outrage and you're getting the Tea Party. Right? But if you approach it from the other direction, one of the things that's often been pointed out by economists is that if you try and set wage levels, if you try and say, you know, there's a minimum wage at a particular level, it may mean that people who are in unions and under awards get more pay than they would otherwise do. It also tends to mean that fewer people get jobs at all. If you reinforce that by making it very difficult for employers, in the name of social justice, to hire and fire with ease, then they'll often not hire for the same reason, because they can't fire. So getting the balance right in terms of opportunity and reward is a very difficult issue. And what I'm suggesting at the moment is that in the name of decency and social justice, since the Depression, in many respects because of the Depression, all the Western economies, and the United States has actually by and large been among them, have spent a lot of public money trying to remedy that situation. But we've got to a situation where we've got to fundamentally rethink that model. I haven't come tonight to give you a lecture about exactly what should be done, because frankly I don't know, but there's a lot of hard thinking to be done. And if we take that in the right spirit, given our long tradition in Western civilization of institutional innovation well-intended public policy, often with good results, then there are some grounds for believing we can do it. But at the moment, we're not doing it. Not the Europeans, not the Americans. And in Australia, we're in a slightly better position, but I think we've got a government at the moment that's all at sea when it comes to those principles. Yeah.
Ernest Roderick, Pemberley Institute. Doctor, you said that sustainability must be assured. Mm-hmm. I thoroughly agree with that as a guideline. Now, if you were the newly elected president of the United States with a four-year term ahead of you, what would you do?
Yeah, we go from a question that I thought was a big one to an even bigger one. What would I do? Heavens above. But let me perhaps try and, if I may, pose the question in a slightly different way, and that is to say, if I'm Barack Obama, right, who may well be the next president of the United States, what can he do? Because it's all very well to say notionally, if I was the president, I would do such and such. Well, if you are in fact the president, there are great constraints on what you can do, right? But one of the more famous American presidents and still venerated is Franklin Roosevelt, and he came to power immediately, you know, after the Great Crash, or in fact 3 years after the Great Crash, but as the onset of the Great Depression was becoming evident. And he said, look, we have to tackle this problem, and I don't know exactly how we're going to solve it, so we're going to try things, and if they don't work, we'll try something else, but we're not going to freeze in fear. I think to some extent Obama, from the time of his first presidential campaign, has been a bit like that. You know, he said, look, we've got to bring the country together again. We've got to stop thinking in terms of red states and blue states and more about the United States, you know. And I think those were among the reasons that he got elected. And then he discovered, as the next president of the United States, just how big a problem he'd inherited, or pile of problems to be precise. I think one thing he's got to do is, and he's been trying so far without success, is he's got to find a way to get the ideological Democrats to acknowledge that the debt situation in the United States is really parlous, and that they can't borrow their way out of that, really. But at the same time, he's got to find a way to get the more tractable Republicans to work with him on a viable means to bring that situation under control. And his efforts so far, it seems to me, have led the Republican Party as an institution to say, if we don't cooperate with him, we can blame him for the problem, and then we might get the White House back. That's the way the partisan system is set up. It's a bit like Tony Abbott at the moment, one might say, you know, hammering the government every way he can. And if you asked, just to swing to the Australian scene for a moment, you know, if you ask Liberal Party diehards, you know, is this a good strategy? My guess is that many of them would say, at least privately, well, it's working. We're way up in the polls. Gillard's on the ropes. Why would we do anything else? That's, so when I talk about our democratic institutions not always working for us, that's part of the reason. The problem being, of course, if you then say, okay, so those institutions don't work, let's do what the Romans did, fight over it and have a dictator who'll sort things out. Well, we've got enough historical experience surely now to realise that that has a very serious downside. It's very hard to get the right dictator and then to get rid of him. So that's, you know, that's about as good as I can do in a short compass to answer your question. But what I would say is this. All those of us who regard ourselves as intelligent, as educated, as concerned citizens of Western democracies should be doing whatever we can to be informed and thoughtful about these issues and to contributing. We can contribute, of course, virtually not at all to what happens in the United States, but we can at least take an active interest in it, because as I said, we're part of the Roman world.
Michael Hellman, a council member, your rather dyspeptic analysis of the current situation. Wouldn't that be the case? I mean, if you look back 50 years, there would have been a much more dyspeptic analysis, because we had the Cuban Missile Crisis and people have been talking about the end of the world with the nuclear bomb, and then you would have had Malthus talking about us running out of food. Don't you really ignore, and don't most of the pessimists ignore, the huge progress that's been made in the world? Women are better off, homosexuals are better off, ethnic minorities are better off, animals are treated better. I mean, like 20 years ago, people wouldn't have worried about what's happened to those cattle. I don't eat meat, so you know, I have a rather different view on why people get so uptight about it. But what I'm saying is, hasn't there been a huge amount of progress in the world? And that, and the dyspeptic view that people always want to take, isn't that not a proper assessment of the current situation?
Well, if you want to make a net assessment, you know, there are so many things to be weighed up that one could say, you look at it from one angle and you see the good stuff, and you look at it from another angle, you see the bad stuff, and it's a bit like shifting moods, you know, you look at your own life sometimes and you oscillate that way. Certainly, I would be the last to deny that in the last half century in the Western world, some extraordinarily fine things have happened. And in the world at large. I mean, you look at China, and so many people are saying, well, look, there are human rights abuses in China, there's environmental disasters occurring in China, there's, you know, there's still a dictatorship by any other name, and lots of Dickensian and unpleasant things are occurring, you know, as people struggle and scrabble and so on. On the other hand, you know, who would have thought 40 or 50 years ago that China would be anything like as open and certainly as prosperous as it's become? So I don't want to suggest that that it's all bad, but the point I'm trying to make is this. One would have liked to think, and you go back only 12 or 15 years, and I think many people were thinking, Michael Mandelbaum at the turn of the century certainly was, that actually everything's turning out really rather well. You know, we're on the right track. And the United States is preeminent, and its model of both politics and economics is now basically becoming the global norm. And then we've got all this stuff. And we need to tidy it up rather urgently. And similarly with the European Union, you know, there was a time only a few years ago when the EU was saying, look, what everyone thinks of America, we're better. You know, we've abolished war, we're working together, we're very prosperous, and we have greater social protection for people. Now it's starting to come apart at the seams in a lot of ways. And what I'm suggesting is not that that everything's necessarily going to go bad, but that there are some very serious challenges that we have to address if they are not going to go bad. And that, you know, it won't do to brush those aside and say, no, basically everything's okay, really any more than it served the people at Las Vegas in January 2007, the little anecdote that I used, to hear John Devaney saying what he was saying and then just basically pretend he hadn't said it.
Peter Edwards. I wonder if you would agree with the statement that part of the problem is that the United States is trying to solve 21st century problems with an 18th century constitution, and that they separate the things that ought not to be separated, the legislature and the executive, and they also, and we often forget this, they combine the two things which ought not to be combined. And I hope Australia doesn't do this, make the mistake of combining head of state and head of executive. And that's part of it. I'm not saying it's the whole problem, but that's part of what makes it so difficult for Obama or any other putative president to get a handle on this problem.
That's a good question, and I've referred to Rome a couple of times in the talk, and I'll never forget as an undergraduate reading Theodore Mommsen's Great History of the Roman Republic, and an arresting sentence at one point towards the end of it, where he says that if you were a dispassionate observer, you would have seen the Republic's constitution just grinding to a halt, and building up tension in it that was set to explode. And nobody apparently could do anything about this. You know, various visionary people tried reforms, and they'd either get assassinated like the Gracchi, or they'd realise they couldn't do anything, and they'd become fatalistic about it, like Sulla, or they'd think, like Marius and eventually Caesar, the only way you're going to be able to change it is to get an army at your back and become a dictator. And Caesar did it, and he got assassinated, and so on. So your constitutions, once in place, can actually be very difficult to fundamentally reform, and I think it's a very interesting question as to whether the American Constitution does have some fundamental problems. That said, if you look at the fiscal situation of the United Kingdom right now, it's not a whole lot better than the United States. And it's also an 18th century constitution, you might say, even a 17th century one. It's not self-evident that the fiscal problems of the EU, which are serious, are any more tractable than those of the Americans, and yet they've got a different system of government. Japan is slightly different again, and they're in more debt than the United States. So exactly what the relationship is between the problems one's trying to fix, the mechanism for trying to fix it, and the people who are working in that mechanism requires some careful thought, I would have said.
Ghazi, and I'm really interested in what you were saying about, I agree with you with public finance being the really big compelling kind of ticking time bomb. In America, the real problem seems to be, as you pointed out, Social Security, Medicare. And there's a lot of cynicism that about basically it can't be, or it's always deferred, mostly because of the demographics of the baby boom generation kind of driving a lot of American politics. As someone too young to have actually remembered the reforms, I'm interested if there's anything we could learn from superannuation in Australia to solving those kinds of problems in America.
Let me understand your question. So you're saying you don't remember the reforms of the 1960s or 70s that led to the social welfare entitlement?
No, I mean the introduction of superannuation.
Oh, so you don't remember that either? right.
I do.
So if I've understood your question, you're saying that the introduction of compulsory superannuation was a measure taken by the Australian government in the belief that if we didn't have something like that in place, then we'd have too many people expecting pensions that couldn't be funded. So we had to get them somehow or other to save for their retirement. Yes?
I'm not sure that's entirely the motivation, but after the
Yeah. I think it largely was. And hopefully it'll work. The overarching question presumably is, are there measures that governments can reasonably take, particularly in democracies where after all they've got to get them through, that would relieve some of this pressure of expectation on governments and both require and enable the ordinary run of people to make better provision for themselves, to take more responsibility for themselves, but in such a way that it's more likely to happen than not. Because you go back to the Great Depression, or you go back to the 1890s, and there's no doubt when there's an economic downturn, there's some very genuine hardship that occurs. But even there, when I talk about being thoughtful, you know, some of the more recent history of the Great Depression, including of Australia, have suggested that myths can grow up about just exactly how much suffering and by whom and for what precise reason occurred. So it repays us, when we're trying to get better social policy for the 21st century, to re-examine long-held assumptions, to re-examine historical myths, to avoid ideological slogans, and to look for data that enables us to test these things and reframe the way we're looking at it. Because if you stick with your assumptions, you're very likely to generate some similar kind of judgment and response, and so far that doesn't seem to have quite cut it.
Thank you.
Two questions.
Please identify yourself.
Leon, sure. Currently the debt of the United States is about $44.2 trillion, and it's bouncing up against its legislative debt ceiling. since 1945, my understanding is that the United States is on a budget surplus 11 years only. What is the likelihood of its deficit coming down, given that historical background? And if it doesn't, what would be the catalyst for this significant political change or constitutional change?
I thought what you were about to say is if it doesn't, will we see a shift in the international monetary and trade regime? Because that's what people are often asking. Will the dollar cease to be the standard international currency? It's great, isn't it? You stand up and then people think you can answer any question on the sun. let me say this. In the late 1990s, the Clinton administration started running budget surpluses, and it was starting to be reported that if you looked out 20 years, if things kept going that way, they'd actually be able to pay down their debt, pretty much as Australia did under the Howard government. Well, that certainly changed. Now, the reason it changed, most obviously, was that, as I said earlier, the Republicans came in and decided to go for tax cuts and launch two wars. Let it be said that it's not only Republicans or people like Bush and Cheney who do that. Lyndon Johnson did the same in the 60s with the Vietnam War. He wanted the Great Society and the Vietnam War. He refused to choose. And the fundamental law of economics is you must choose. You've got to acknowledge their opportunity costs. And I think the real problem the United States has had, which has now got to the point where it really can't be evaded any longer, is that being such a large and rich country where everything seemed solvable, they thought they could do it all. And even the United States can't do it all, not without some better economic thought and prudence. That's the fundamental lesson now. But you asked, at what point, if they can't turn this around, will it lead to a constitutional crisis and reform? That, needless to say, is a question I can't very readily answer, but it's something that the thrust of my talk tonight is saying we really should be thinking about. And that's why I quoted the 18th century thinker as saying democracies tend to go down the gurgler because voters, once they realise they can pay themselves largesse out of the public purse, get a bit carried away. You know, in when the American Constitution was first framed, it was framed by men who inherited a tradition from the classical world which said democracy doesn't work, and by and large for that reason. And that's why most people in between had said the only way to do it is to have the few rule, or possibly a monarch, constitutional or absolute. But they thought, we want more of a democracy. We want a republic, certainly. We want a constitutional government. They still, on the whole, thought that the propertied class rather than the hoi polloi should run it, and they didn't even think about women or blacks being part of it. At least that's a slightly sweeping statement, but basically it's the case, right? The thing is that they thought they could make it work, and they were trying to think through how we make it work. And I think we're at a point now where we're running much larger, much more complex, much more fast-moving societies, and we have to have people do the kind of calibre of thinking about those problems that Madison and Jay and Jefferson and the others were doing in the late 18th century in the United States.
Yes. Stuart Cleland. America's got a lot of economic problems, and you've touched on a lot of them in your talk. First of all, it was the greedy bankers and fund managers that caused the subprime crisis, so that was a huge trigger. But also, as manufacturing is left a lot of American cities, especially the ones in the northeast, and manufacturing is now done essentially in China. I mean, there's always manufacturing everywhere, but China has become the manufacturer of the world almost, and that's just increasing. So that's led to unemployment in the States of 9.5-10%, something like that, isn't it? So that's the second economic problem. The third one you touched on earlier was two expensive wars. One would think if you stop being in a war, that's a huge cost not being incurred, let alone cost to the lives and so on. And then the last main thing you touched on was the lack of the social security in the States compared to, say, here with superannuation, with our Medicare and things like that. So there's four problems, as I would see it, economically. But it's interesting that Warren Buffett, who's one of the best investors of all time. He's very confident about, in his annual review this year, that America will in fact bounce back. So we've got the four problems, there's probably lots of others, but I would think, someone asked you earlier, if there was a new president, what would he do? Well, they are the four key economic problems, and one way or another, they've got to be focused on.
Yeah. Let me just say, in response to your remarks, I'd like to read, because I haven't, exactly what Warren Buffett thinks are the grounds for optimism, by which I don't mean to say that there are no grounds for believing that the US could bounce back, but, you know, the bigger the hole you're in, the bigger the jump you've got to make to get out of it. And they're certainly in a bigger hole at the moment, I think, than they've been in their history.
Breath of one, and then we'll go to the back. First and second.
In consideration of your background, tipping the writings you've done on defence, security in China, the implications for Australia, and the obligations we have for the ANZUS alliance, what would you prophesize that the US would ask us to do in the future in regards to the alliance, and particularly in the rise of China?
I'm a bit wary of the word prophesize, though I might have sounded a bit like Jeremiah here this evening. I take it what you mean is, in the event that there is a collision between the United States and China, what would you think we would be called on to do? Is that what you mean?
Well, not really. Even just the extent of the circumstance the US finds itself in now, would the obligations on its allies be a lot more than they were previously, do you think?
Oh, I see what you mean. So you're saying that just the extent that the fiscal condition of the United States leads it to actually be unable to do some or even a good deal of what it's doing, what pressure will that put on us? Well, I think this is a debate that's starting to be actively engaged in Australia. And it's interesting that, of course, there are various possible responses. And by and large, they tend to be focused on the rise of China because it's seen as the leading candidate to displace US power in the Western Pacific and Southeast Asia. And a lot of the debate centers on, well, first of all, how realistic to think that China is actually going to do that rather than, you know, a fear that it could. And secondly, if it did, would it necessarily be bad? And even if it was bad, what could we really do about it? So many of you will be aware that Hugh White, for example, has been arguing, look, it probably will displace the United States. We probably need to urge the United States to accept that because fighting it is just going to lead to a disastrous collision which will be in nobody's interest. And we ourselves should accommodate that because we have a lot to gain by a relationship with China, and China will seek the prerogatives of great power, and to some extent we've simply got to, you know, come to terms with it. Ross Babbage, on the other hand, and quite a few people in defence, and it would appear, you know, Kevin Rudd, at least when he was Prime Minister, have taken a view that, well, they don't welcome that, and they think that we should substantially increase our military capabilities so that we're in a position to resist an attempt by China to exert hegemony in the region. That raises really interesting questions. My own view has always been that rather than, you know, saying we must do this specific thing, given how uncertain the future is, we should at all times, through whatever instrumentalities we have, the DFAT, the intelligence agencies, the better thoughtful people in universities and leading political figures, be seeking to maximise our freedom of manoeuvre rather than just being either fatalistic or complacent. And there's no question in my mind that if we are to maximise our freedom of manoeuvre in these changing circumstances, then there are two things we very definitely need to do. One of them is we need to make sure that we keep, to the best of our ability, our own economic house in order and not go too far down the path that the EU and in a different way the United States have done. And the other is that we need to think very hard and very adroitly about exactly how we relate to China, not kowtowing, not being unnecessarily provocative or hostile. And that will take a degree of subtlety which we're, you might say, not accustomed to exercising.
At the back, please.
I agree with the general tenet of what you're saying, Seamus News. Our international communists have just got two bombshells. One is by September the deficit will be added 1.645 trillion. And the second thing you point out is that the 10-year treasury has gone down to below 3%, which is from 4.5%, which is a bubble waiting to explode. Do you think Obama is being pusillanimous in not increasing the tax on some people who could afford to pay.
I'm not sure whether it would be altogether fair to Obama to call him pusillanimous, because the difficulty is that he simply can't do that unilaterally. He's got to get support of his own party. He's got to get it through Congress. He's got to have voters prepared to wear it, and that's a very complex game. I don't know how many of you were ever fans of the West Wing, you know, but they were forever, I thought, running a very neat, if rather sweetened, tutorial on political realities, because they were always discussing how do you build a coalition, how do you get people to understand, what about this congressman, that interest group, etc. That's the problem that Obama's got. Part of it, as Peter Edwards was saying, is a constitutional problem, but as I said in my response, I think if he was the Prime Minister of Britain, he would still find that there are serious problems in addressing these issues. But I think I would add that it certainly appears when you get a small number, let's say the top 1% or even fewer of American income earners, earning vastly more than the others, it looks as though there's a great deal of revenue to be gained by ramping up their taxes. But that can be an illusion to a significant extent, because they are a very small proportion of the population. Mm-hmm. And the argument that McDonald puts is that in the Western democracies at large, and certainly in the United States, once taxation got to about 20% of GDP, that was pretty much the level of tolerance, right? That the polities as a whole were not really prepared to accept very much more than that. And that's why the debt level started to build up. What has to be reorganised and deleveraged, if you like, are people's expectations of what the government is supposed to provide. And that's a very complex problem, because nobody wants to let go. It's not just a matter of a few genuinely underprivileged people. Once people have got entitlements, they see them as a birthright, and they get to vote. You know those slogans that some people have on cars, "I shoot and I vote"? Well...
Okay, do we have any more questions?
There's a hand over there.
Yes, thank you.
Hi, Jason Dess. I think it's fair to say that US economic policy has influenced sort of world economic policy over the last sort of 50 years. Do you think that with the decline of the US economy that governments will be looked to the more successful economies in China and India, like the rise of those kind of countries, and see their economic policies and differences between them, that this might change sort of world economic policies, like change the views of governments and how they manage their economies?
We have to be a little careful when we talk about success there, would be my first response. So, you know, in March this year, Wen Jiabao, the Chinese Premier, actually said publicly, and I thought it was very interesting and unusually candid for any Chinese leader, it must be said, he said, "Our economic model is currently uncoordinated, unbalanced, and unsustainable, and it needs reform, and it will require political reform, no harm bene, if we're to handle these issues." China, like the other East Asian economies, has been able to grow with enormous rapidity and pile up surpluses in significant measure over the last half century or so, because the US opened its market, and by and large liberal internationalists in the United States believed if they opened their markets, everybody would benefit, right? As the old saying has it, a rising tide lifts all boats. And to some extent, that's been true, right? The growth in the global economy, the overall growth in prosperity, the growth in living standards for hundreds of millions of people around the world has been unmistakable. But it hasn't worked out altogether as sweetly as it might have. And part of that is because of the way the US has managed its own domestic economy. Part of it is miscalculation, one would say, about just how readily or evenly free trade would serve its interests as well as that of others. And part of it is that the East Asian economies, and most notably the Chinese right now, have largely run a mercantilist policy. They've thought, great, we'll have everything the Americans can give us, foreign direct investment, technology, you know, a market for our manufacturers. But actually, they're still very inclined to protect their own market and not allow substantial investment in strategic industries, and increasingly the evidence is they're trying to acquire the IP of anybody wanting to set up plant in China, so you basically get handed all over. at which point what's going to happen is they'll set up a Chinese, largely state-run or state-owned enterprise that will duplicate it, and the people hoping for a large market cash in on their investment will find that it's really not there. And my understanding is a number of major companies, Boeing certainly among them, have found that this has occurred and have said, well, this is not the deal we're up for and this is not working for us. So is the Chinese model working? Well, only if you take a rather narrow view of it. And although it to some extent looks like a brave call right now, I think there are reasons for thinking that for very different reasons to the United States, unless the Chinese Communist Party can bring itself to make some quite fundamental institutional reforms, it too will run into heavy weather in the next decade or so. And there's not many people making that call at the moment. At the moment, you look at superficially at it, piling up foreign exchange reserves and pouring out manufacturers, and you think, gee, what's not to like about that? Well, in terms of overall balance and sustainability, there's actually quite a bit.
And those will be the last questions. Thank you.
I'm just clarifying your comments earlier about our welfare system and our expectations of government and how that has sustainable this idea. And also considering the success of welfare states and their resources.
Sorry, could you just repeat the question? I didn't quite.
So you were saying that we should reconsider how we perceive the idea of welfare and the expectation that government should provide a lot of things. Could you just clarify what you meant by that? And then also how that idea can be considered in light of the welfare states like England and those countries that have done quite well with a high level of government involvement?
I guess to try and keep it brief, I'd say three things. The first is that in the 1930s, when the idea of the government taking a more interventionist role in the economy was first seriously accepted within liberal economic circles as distinct from socialist ones, it was the Keynesian idea that unless the government was prepared at intervals to step in and pump prime the economy, then downturns could be prolonged and social suffering exacerbated. But the basic idea there was that you would sort of give it a bit of a push and then it would be up and running and largely self-sustaining after that. The difficulty, as Keynes himself acknowledged later, was that once you step in, it's actually very difficult for democratic government to step back again. And so you start by, as people still talk about, trying to create some jobs for the sake of greater liquidity or effective demand in the economy, and then you find that people, once you've created those jobs, not only don't want to give them up, they want more of them. And then after the war, after the Second World War, famously in Britain, but in many of the Western democracies, there was this general sense, we've gone through a very hard time, depression and war, and we want a better life. And political parties started, by and large, to compete for what they could offer those constituents in terms of all the appurtenances of a better life. As a government, not simply as those people trying to provide the conditions for the economy to provide those things. And because, by and large, that era was one of robust economic growth and expansion for a number of complex reasons, you could say for some time that appeared to yield the goods. And let's not gainsay the fact that a great many people during that time did gain from public largesse, which is what it was. The problem is that exacerbated the dilemma that governments had, in the same way that the initial pump priming had, because once you start saying, well, we'll pay for your medical expenses, we'll pay for your pensions, we'll pay for your education, etc., people want better healthcare, bigger pensions, more education, advanced education, all right? They want to work fewer hours, they want penalty rates, etc. All this has just grown and grown and grown, and it simply isn't fiscally sustainable. That doesn't mean that it's a bad idea for people to have some form, somehow, of sound medical care and so forth. Consider that during the same period of time, two other things exacerbated that demographically. One was that the post-war period gave rise, as somebody remarked earlier, to the baby boomer generation, a larger than usual cohort, a growing population. So the number of people drawing these increasing benefits was larger than before. And partly because conditions of living had improved, people lived longer, which greatly increases the medical expenses. Even in the normal course of events, aged people just require more, right? So this has just grown and grown, and it's not just the United States. all the European countries, the Swedes, who had a pioneering model of social democracy, cradle to grave security, found by about 20 years ago, hey, we're looking ahead a bit and thinking, this is going to bankrupt us. We've got to find a way to climb down, and it's difficult. So nobody, to my knowledge, is seriously suggesting that one should, even if one could, simply jettison all of that and say, you're all on your own. That would lead to social chaos. But the question is, how do you deleverage? It's really like the investment banks on Wall Street in 2007 started to wake up, you know, and realize, hey, you know, we're leveraged to a ratio of 30, 35 to 1. That's really dangerous, you know, because you're just a fraction of a downturn in your market and you're actually underwater. And Bear Stearns went underwater and Lehman Brothers went underwater, and, you know. So that's the kind of problem I'm pointing to.
Okay, last question.
William Kirchhoff, I'm a member and I go with Roe. Obama's critics have said that he doesn't believe in American exceptionalism. I just wanted you to touch on whether American exceptionalism has been positive or negative.
Oh, another simple and easy question to answer. If by American exceptionalism we mean those things which, in fact, in the view of American isolationists 100 years ago or so used to set America apart, that is, that it wasn't party to all the old corruptions and class systems and conflicts of the old world, and it was the home of the brave and the land of the free, you know, and as Reagan said much more recently, mankind's last best hope on earth, you know, and a place to which people from all over the world wanted to go, and many still do, seeking opportunity. You could say, look, as one of the questioners down the back put it before, there's been a lot of upside to that. America has, in a lot of ways, been a remarkable country and done a great deal of good. On the other hand, it's long since ceased to be isolationist. Once it became liberal internationalist, it very much became party to all the old problems of class structures and corruption and revolution and war. Right? And that's come close to tearing the Republic apart. Right? And it's still a big issue for them. So it's become fraught in that context. But then there's a third dimension to it, which is the one, in a sense, we've just been discussing. If America had, in fact, kept its fiscal house in order at a time when, say, the Europeans and the Japanese were floundering, it really would have looked exceptional. All right? If it manages, despite its current difficulties, really to do what Warren Buffett apparently believes it can, and to bounce back and once again set an example of innovation and prosperity, I'll be the first to rejoice. I mean, the real thrust of what I'm saying is I would have hoped that that would be the case, and I'm very concerned at the moment that it might not be. So I certainly don't have an animus against the ways in which America has been an exceptional country. And what had been hoped by the liberal internationalists is that those virtues could be globalised. And when Michael Mandelbaum published his book only about a decade ago, he was effectively saying they are being globalised. The world's going to become more like America. Well, maybe. But we've got a long way to go.
Well, Porter, thank you for your fascinating talk. I'll ask Tim Healy from our executive committee to propose a vote of thank you.
Well, it's great that there's so many people have come out tonight. It's a very large crowd, and it's a great tribute to Paul, and I think to the topic particularly, because we've been privileged to a tour de force from one of the great friends of the Institute. Paul's addressed us on a number of occasions and have always been fascinating and drawn on his very wide intellectual background. Tonight we drew back into Roman history to give us an understanding of some of the complexities in the United States. The thing that lots of things could be said, and I don't intend to speak for very long, but the thing that struck me and very much about the last few years of America has been the excesses, and Paul talked about, just as an example, the excesses of Wall Street and the inconceivability of the sort of amounts of money that people were paying themselves, hundreds of millions of dollars. It's beyond our understanding of what is sensible, what could be morally, what right, and yet this went on. In the United States government, I read today, for instance, that the war in Afghanistan, which they can't afford, which is being funded essentially by borrowing from the Chinese, is costing $10 billion a month. $10 billion a month. $120 billion a year. I watched from afar over the last year or so the debate in America on the health, the proposals for some sort of universal health cover, although it wasn't by our standards a universal health cover. The United States today is spending something like 17% of its GDP, the size of its economy, on health. That's nearly double what the rest of the Western world are spending on health. It's getting for it at the moment a system which does not cover 60 million Americans. It has lower health outcomes than even Cuba in terms of life expectancy. I listened to, the NewsHour, the PBS program of American senators saying we have the best health system in the world. And at one level, I think they were right. If you were a very rich person working in Wall Street, you'd have superb health cover, health, anything you wanted. But here's a nation spending, naturally, you think about the economic impact of spending nearly double what other West, I think Australia spends 9 or 10%. We're at the higher end of the Western world in health. Most of Western Europe, Britain spends about 9%. The United States is spending 17%. It's spending much more on defence than the other Western countries. So something has to give. What's giving, for instance, is its ability to invest in R&D. It's certainly in infrastructure. Its infrastructure is collapsing. It's got huge infrastructure problems. Can't fund. So these are some of the enormous problems it faces. We had some terrific questions. One of them inviting Paul to be president for a moment. Thought we had the wrong logo on here. We're not sure. Tea party, maybe. I was just thinking also what we could, a few things we could take for ourselves in Australia. If you read the Economist article last week, and it made some comment on the superannuation system we had here, and we got a very interesting question from this gentleman here, and I think that's one of the better things we've done in the last 20 years, because we do have a huge, apart from the fact that we're attempting to get people to provide for themselves, it's provided a very large a pool of savings which can be invested. And that was one of the very positive things the Economist said. I also think that looking at what's happening in the world today, we need to think very seriously about how we handle the temporary riches we're receiving, the minerals boom. This is for another time, question of what we do with that, how the whole of this country shares in that, whether we have a wealth fund or whatever, I think is worth thinking about. And I was thinking of that in terms of some of the issues that Paul was raising about the difficulties that the United States is having in managing its affairs. I don't know whether I would say it's ungovernable, but it's pretty damned hard. Paul, I think we were treated to a really fascinating talk, and the quality of the questions reflected that. And we're very grateful, and I'd ask you all to thank Paul in a normal way.